You are listening to KiwiRadio.nz. Doing a live show for you this Sunday, 11th December 2022, New Zealand time. It's just past 8:20 p.m. Here's one for all the West Aucklanders, Guns N' Roses, Welcome to the Jungle. If you saw them live this weekend, they were here in New Zealand. It was a big weekend for gigs, actually. Jack Johnson was also over here. Princess Chelsea, one of my favourite Kiwi musicians, was doing a gig as well. I went to none of the above. Broke as. Yep. So just stayed home, looked after my bubba. But here's a good Guns N' Roses song for you. Got some Meat Puppets and Megadeth coming up as well, and a special guest from Canada. Back with you in about 3.5 minutes. Stay tuned. We're going to have a casual yarn and play some tunes in between. KiwiRadio.nz. Jungle. It's a jungle out there. All right, we'll get started with the show. I've got a good friend on the line. Just gonna have a good yarn, really, while I eat my chips. That's what you do in New Zealand. You eat chips. That's all we eat. Nothing else. Maybe that and Weet-Bix. Anyways, welcome to the jungle there. Supreme Cannon, thanks for joining us on the show today. How are you doing?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Ralphie. Long time no chat, man.
I always love chatting to you, man. It's always pretty casual. What's on your mind?
Well, what a year it's been, hey? It's crazy.
Tell me, what are some of the highlights for you?
Yeah. Well, the thing that really got me thinking that things were accelerating was, of course, the outbreak of this war in Central Europe. We have an actual hot war going on in Europe.
Well,
you know, and this time it's not NATO, it's not NATO calling the shots for the first time in, since World War II.
I'm going to actually just sit back and I'm going to listen to your soothing voice while I eat my chips.
Okay.
But, so I'm going to act
sure,
as the I'm going to act as the facilitator of the show. But yeah, the floor is yours. So go on, tell me.
Okay. Well, a brief history, as I understand it, of what's happening in Central Europe right now. Basically, when the Soviet Union imploded in 1991, that left the United States at the top of the heap. Now, the United States, of course, has had its own problems, but this basically left them at the top, and it basically left the second world, the old communist bloc, leaderless and unguided, and it gave them the opportunity to swoop in and sweep up Central Europe, absorb them into the EU, absorb them into NATO, make them part of their bloc. They made several agreements with the Russians over that time, because obviously Russia, although it was now impoverished and chaotic, was open to Western business, but it also still had a lot of nuclear weapons. So needless to say, you know, they had to be kind of ginger about it. But the idea was they were going to go in and scoop up Russian resources, put their people in power, their agents, right, and create a situation where they would essentially dominate Europe from Lisbon all the way to Vladivostok. And, of course, that's difficult because Russians are very intractable in that regard. They weren't going to have that. It was going to be a hard sell.
So what you're telling me is this whole show is a land grab? Or go on.
I think ultimately they wanted a land grab, yeah. But only a land grab in the sense of a proxy. Like, the U.S. doesn't own France. They don't own Germany. They don't own Poland. They don't own Italy. But because they're all in the under the EU umbrella, and because they're part of NATO, the U.S. basically calls the shots for them. Mm. You know, they have it's all influence. It's always behind the scenes. It's never going to be naked. Okay, you're our empire. You have to do what we say. It's always going to be leveraged behind the scenes. And some places it works better than others. But for the most part, the U.S. has dominated that part of the world since the end of World War II. And then once the Soviet Union collapsed, well, then they moved their borders further east. And the U.S. had its own structural problems that weren't being solved. And now they've come to a head as well. You saw the tech crash in 2000, right?
Yes.
Rather than let the system reset, get rid of the bad investment, they just dropped interest rates and pumped more money into the economy, flooded the economy, and for the next, you know, it bought them 7 or 8 years. But basically, by the middle of 2007, there were already problems starting to emerge that ultimately culminated in the financial crisis of 2008. At this point in time, you could say that they didn't have any new ideas. There was no interest in a reckoning. There was no interest in letting the system reset because there were going to be too many people with power and influence that weren't going to have a job anymore. Some of them could have wound up in prison, right? They weren't going to let that happen. So they dropped interest rates and flooded the world again. And now we've reached 2022. You've had 2 years of the pandemic, enormous global economic disruption. So they had to flood the world with more money. Every nation in the world was doing the same thing, right? So now all of this liquidity is starting to show up in everyday items. When it was going into the stock market, when it was going into the debt market, when it was going into especially the real estate market, right? You've seen the insanity in New Zealand and Australia. Well, it's just as bad in Canada. It's absolutely outlandish.
Oh, right, in the space
of a basic commodity that everyone needs.
Housing, right? In the space of 2 years, we've gone from average 3% to now 7%. It's ramped up pretty quick.
It has, yeah. Interest rates have gone up because you've got the world basically flying on one engine, and that engine is the U.S. consumer.
Yes.
And when the U.S. consumer can't get cheap food and energy and tchotchkes to buy, then that's a political earthquake, a volcano waiting to erupt. So as I see it in this case, the American Central Bank had no choice but to raise interest rates to try to cool this off and sop up some of that extra liquidity. If a bunch of people lose their jobs and they create a recession, well, obviously they're hoping to bring it all into a safe landing. But you've got these disruptions happening all over the world. And I don't think that they're going to be able to control it this time. So that's why you're seeing interest rates go up the way they are. I don't think the intention is to keep them there long.
Oh, okay.
It's not even necessarily a matter. Yeah, I don't think they're going back to zero, Ralphie, but I don't think they might go back to something historically more normal.
There was
talk
of
a Fed funds rate of 3%.
There was talk of percentages almost going negative at some point, but never saw that happen in New Zealand anyway. What about you over there?
Sure. Well, I mean, they were functionally negative anyway, because the real, you know, consumer price index was always high. Right? And if you're basically, the bank is paying you a quarter of a percent for your money and your inflation is 4%, well, I mean, that's a negative interest rate. You've got nowhere to park your money. You have to speculate. Yeah. You got to put your money into more and more risky assets to try to get the same return, especially people that are invested in pension funds, you know, hedge funds, you know, income instruments, right? Things that will pay you a pension or finance your retirement. This is the thing that the institutional money was looking for. And it also went into things like the whole crypto complex, right?
I was going to ask you what your opinion was on crypto, with it tanking now as well. I mean, it peaked at 80,000
US,
and now it's like, what, 10,000? But I always say it's still 10,000 over its asking price, you know, should be a dollar.
Well, I'm inclined to think so. Obviously, a lot of people, they see the logic of crypto, especially Bitcoin. I see the logic of it. I don't disagree with that. But the problem is that all of these cryptos at the end of the day are still priced in US dollars. So they're still tied to the a fiat value. Well, as long as money is cheap, you can speculate in these things. But isn't it funny that as soon as interest rates went up and liquidity began to dry up, the credit markets began to dry up, crypto collapsed?
Well,
right?
The faith in crypto for me just demolished after the freezing of accounts over there in Canada. So,
well, sure. Yeah. What happened with FTX? I'll be honest with you. I'd never heard of FTX until after the crash. I didn't know that they had celebrity endorsements. I didn't know that they actually had their name on like a sports stadium. That's how fast these things come and go.
For those not versed, FTX meaning FedEx Corp, or?
No, FTX was a crypto exchange.
Right. It was
something like, Binance, or I'm not familiar with all the names by any means, but, you know, most crypto is being traded in exchanges, right? Like stocks, right? Everything gets traded in and out of an exchange. Well, you had all these rival exchanges.
There's no anonymity now in crypto. That was one of the first desirables about it. But now with the exchanges, you have to verify yourself now. So it's no longer anonymous.
You do. That's right. Well, the trouble with crypto, even Bitcoin, right? Things like Bitcoin, you know, you're purchasing it with fiat currency. Depending on where you live in the world, you have to transfer it into whatever your local currency is. So there's an on ramp into the crypto world, and then you have to take the off ramp back out of it in order to use the money to buy what it is you need to buy.
Well, transferring one faith base to another.
Basically, yeah. So I mean, the banks can look at where you are, even if they don't know what your crypto's worth. Even if they couldn't get into the exchanges and seize your money or freeze your account, they know where you went. And when you come back out, they have a record of that as well. So they know you're there, which is just as bad as them knowing exactly what you have and what you're doing with it.
What's your take?
Right? I mean, you, you, you go in and then you come back out again. They see you going in and coming out. So it's not like they,
yes, they
it's
do.
Not like they don't know that you own cryptocurrencies, right?
Yes, that absolutely.
And I'm inclined to think that some of these blockchains, as they're set up, they have backdoors. I don't think that there. I don't think there is an anonymous as people would like to believe.
You mean like with Mado pulled down backdoor stuff, or just what do you mean by backdoor?
Well, I think that somewhere in the system, I mean, you need the exchanges themselves. Obviously, they need to know what you own and what your balances are, because when you put in an order to trade, say between one crypto and another, right? Somebody knows about that. That part of the system is not anonymous at all. So all they would have to do is subpoena the records, and they would know who has what. And if you weren't willing to, as I've always said, I mean, maybe they couldn't seize your crypto, but they can seize you.
Yeah, which they have.
You know, they can freeze your, which they have. They can freeze your bank accounts. Ultimately, you have to trade it back into whatever your national currency is, wherever you are, in order to actually be able to use it, because there aren't too many places that have actually accepted Bitcoin or Monero. I think it was Monero, where they actually had a credit card.
Yes, yes.
This is, I mean, it's, you might come out the other end of the turbulence and have a couple still existing and usable, but I look at it like the dot-com boom in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you go back to say the turn of the 20th century, when you had 3,000 automakers in the United States, right? Ultimately, you wound up with the big three. You had Ford, you had General Motors, and you had Chrysler, Dodge. Right? Everybody else got bought up or they went out of business. And I think it's the same in the tech world. There were a lot of .coms that came and went. They just imploded.
Right.
The
search engines as well.
Bitcoin
run up. You had the Google, the Yahoo, and I mean, you have all sorts of search engines, but yeah, absolutely. It's the trickle-up effect of any sort of commerce, right? Yeah, I agree. What is your take on CBDCs, though, especially that's a scary thing because they can central bank digital currency. What is your take on that? I'm gonna ask you straight after the song. Let's get back to some music. Meat Puppets is the band. They're an American rock band formed in 1980, Arizona. Back with our guests straight after the song is Backwater. You're listening to KiwiRadio.nz streaming live.
And when I wake up in the morning, you feel the daybreak on my face. There's a blood that's flowing through the feeling. With a knife to open up the sky's veins. Some things will never change. They stand there looking backwards, half unconscious from the pain. They may seem rearranged. In the backwater swirling, there is something that'll never change. And when I should have been done a long time, it laughs and says I find ways. Just when we're sheltered under paper, the rockets come at us sideways. Some things will never change. They just stand there looking backwards, half unconscious from the pain. They may seem rearranged. In the backwater swirling, there is something that will never change. Some things will never change. They just stand there looking backwards, half unconscious from the pain. They may seem rearranged. In the backwater swirling, there is something that'll never change. Some things will never change. They stand there looking backwards, half unconscious from the pain. They may seem rearranged. In the backwater swirling, there is something that'll never change.
KiwiRadio.nz. You know, some things will never change. I've been doing some light reading. I'm not really a reader, but I found an interesting book on 18th century Great Britain. And even then, in Great Britain, 1800s, there was always war or the perpetual threat of war. And I feel like we're in the same page right now. So some things never change. What do you reckon there, Spring?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. War is war and rumors of wars are the lifeblood of the state. Every empire depends on them. It partly is a threat to keep people in line, partly to make an example of dissenters to keep the rest in line. You know, I'm thinking of Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, for starters, Venezuela, Cuba. The sanctions there that have been going on for a long time in Cuba, really, really beyond any point of necessity, just to maintain the status quo.
Every war is a banker's war.
Every war is a banker's war. Ultimately, yeah. I mean, you can kind of see the point of it, that money is the sinews of war, right? But money is ultimately what we use to obtain all the things we need to survive. I mean, that's why it's so powerful. The people that control the supply of it, this is a very well rehearsed and well practiced routine that they've been using for a very long time. And they also use those ill-gotten gains, of course, to finance all of the terrible things that they've been feeding to us and polluting our cultures with for the last 50 to 100 years.
I mean, absolutely. I think money for me is first of all a human idea, but second of all, it's just an accounting trick. But the problem is now a class of people have used usury on that system, and here we are.
Yeah. Well, the thing about usury, it was the pricing of risk, right? If you've got money and somebody wants to borrow it from you for a period of time, you have to understand that, right? Like, you're going to have to put up some collateral in order to, get this person to let you have that money, right? But in the absence of collateral, okay, well, we'll take a risk premium. That's why you go to buy a house, you buy a car. They want to know your income information. They want 5 years of tax returns, that right. kind of a thing. They want to know that you are a steady earner and that they're going to get their money back, right? And they're taking a risk letting you have that money because they might just get stuck with a pig and a poke, right? And then you declare bankruptcy and then there's nothing they can do about it, right? But they're not really pricing that risk anymore because, they could just print the money. It's not backed by anything.
That's right.
So it's not actually costing them anything to loan you money. And if you fail to pay them back, well, then they can take your house or your car or whatever it is back from you and they can sell it and, recover real dollars from it. They're just mostly conjuring it out of thin air now. So it's not the same as it was back in the days when it was all gold and silver coins circulating or, you paid the doctor for his visit with, chickens or something, money simplified those transactions because it was a commonly agreed value. But money was made of something that took real sweat, toil, and labor to produce as well, right? Like, gold and silver are rare. It takes a lot of sweat and a lot of energy to get that stuff out of the ground and into a usable form. So that's why it's been valuable. People look at gold and say, well, it's just this dumb lump of metal. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't pay a return. But that's the point. All it has to do is exist.
Mm.
You just take it out of the ground and you pour a bar and you put it in another hole in the ground, right? With a garden on top of it. And what's the point? The point is that it exists.
Not only that, gold has other benefits as well, like holding electricity. It's not just a monetary accounting.
That's right. Yeah, especially not so much gold, but silver definitely has a lot of industrial uses in the modern world.
Right.
And it's incredibly valuable for that alone. So, yeah, it's not that I think silver is ever going to go back to be a monetary metal, but historically it always was. And it's the poor man's gold. Right? So if you've got somebody that wants to insulate themselves against extreme financial shocks, and you can't really afford gold, right, other than small amounts of it, well, you can always go to the pawn shop, right? Or you can find a dozen coin dealers online, and you get yourself some silver. And it does the same thing. All it has to do is exist. You put it in your strong box. You put it in your sock drawer. You put it in a coffee can in the backyard, and it's there in case of extreme emergency. And we're reaching a point now where extreme emergencies are unavoidable. I don't think that they're going to be able to print their way out of this one. We got off onto crypto before the call went bluey, but I want to circle back around. We were talking about Central Europe and specifically Russia.
Yes, go on.
Right. Now, part of the reason I believe this is happening is because Ukraine, since the fall of the Soviet Union, has basically been an American proxy state. Right? It's a huge piece of land that had a lot of industry on it, incredible amount of resources. But because it was kind of the Wild West, in terms of law and order, it was also an ideal place for drug runners, for weapons dealers, for human traffickers, right? And you could also launder money through their banks. And basically the place was up for grabs. You know, the large American agricultural corporations have bought up an enormous amount of Ukrainian farmland, right? The coal mines, the chromium, oil and gas, it has all of those things too. And it has all those seaports as well. So it was, and it's the largest, I think the largest producer of sunflowers and seeds and sunflower oil in the world. You know, it's an agricultural gem. It always has been. So while it was under the control of basically the American finance and American State Department, it also had the second largest army in Europe after Russia itself, because it had all of that leftover Soviet equipment. It was a heavily fortified place before the collapse of the Soviet Union, because obviously it was on the border with NATO. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, all that stuff was left behind. So Ukraine had an enormous military machine as well that was now under the control of NATO, a proxy. So it was there and a large ethnic Russian population. So any time that they wanted to poke the Russians in the ribs and really hurt them, like hit them where it hurt, they could start persecuting the Russian population of Ukraine and eventually force the Russians to act. Now, when you go back to 2020, right? You had the pandemic and the response to that. You had the 2020 presidential election, and at least 40% of the population of America believes that election was a fraud. I don't think it's a majority, but it's a sizable enough minority that the legitimacy of the government is permanently called into question. And now you had the same thing happen in 2022. And there are partisans on both sides that will say, yes, it was stolen. And the other side will say, no, it wasn't, but it doesn't matter. The problem is that you no longer have, and there's a point to this, I'll get to it quickly. When you no longer have what is acknowledged to be a transparent and fair election system, it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong. At that point in time, you've got an unstable government. You're going to have pushback. You're going to have pushback at the state level. You're going to have pushback at the county level, okay, because it's kind of a cellular government structure in the United States. And you're also going to have massive pushback at the individual level. you know, private organizations and things like that. So it creates instability in Washington. So they need a diversion. You've flooded the country with money, and now you've got supply chain problems, you've got inflation problems, the cost of energy and food's going up. What usually do governments in trouble do in a situation like that when they can't default on their debt, when they've got nowhere else to go? What do they usually do? They try to get a war going. To try to get a diversion going.
Oh, war's amazing because not only is the conflict profitable, but the contracts to repair everything is also as profitable.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and if you create a state of emergency, then essentially the government at that point in time can rally the people. It can take at least indirect control of large parts of the economy, right? Particularly food and the energy. And if you control those things, I mean, you control people. Right, you can rally people. You know, patriotism has always been called the last refuge of the scoundrel. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of, whether it's our bastard or their bastard, as long as the bastard wraps himself in the flag, he's safe. Right, so you've got a government that's basically under siege, trying to maintain the status quo and continue to advance it with the plans that they've had for decades, and you've got midterms coming up in the fall of 2022. So what do you do? Okay, it's time to do what we didn't get to do for those 4 years when we had this, you know, this orange guy running around wrecking stuff, right? Because they had a plan. They were working on the plan. They always have plans. When you're talking about government, you're talking about governments. I mean, the people at the top, they change all the time. It's the people down in the bowels of the ship, right?
It's the upper and lower management, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the apparatchiks, right? The senior bureaucrats. They're the ones calling the shots most of the time, right? If you set the government in a certain direction, well, they're the ones actually down in the steering room. They're the ones that decide which way the ship's actually going. That's just how it is. So they decided to, give the Ukrainian army orders to move into the Donbass and start shelling civilians and force a response from the Russians. And there are a lot of hardliners in the Kremlin that think that Vladimir Putin is a bleeding heart liberal. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he's in the middle of this thing. He's not a dictator. He's not Stalin or Hitler or stupid things like that, right? He's just, you know, he was the guy that managed to get them back from the brink of extinction. So he's got a lot of respect in that country.
I don't really understand the conflict between Soviets and allies throughout the years, because I mean, I saw a photo of Vladimir Putin shaking hands with George Bush, both wearing the same robes, like, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's been to all of the the rubber chicken, you know, diplomatic dinners and things like that. He's visited with Bill Clinton and George Bush, and I think he's was in contact with Obama. I think during the Obama years, there was more of a focus on antagonizing the Russians and isolating them as much as possible, right? And certainly since this war began, it appears that the plan was to force Russia to commit sufficient atrocities in the Donbass. And that's a long story. We don't even need to get into that. But suffice that this is an area that was very important to Russia because it's ethnic Russians living literally across the frontier from Russia itself. And now you've got Ukrainian army, which is essentially a NATO proxy, going in there and shelling people, shelling civilians. It's been going on for years. So basically, I think the idea was to force his hand so that Russia would have to directly intervene in the Donbass and basically go to war with Ukraine, which is what's happened. But I don't think that was the key point. The key point was Ukrainians will go in there, sit in their fortified bunkers, let the Russians destroy themselves, throwing themselves against these fortifications. And in the meantime, the United States, Europe, and whoever else in the world they can mobilize would throw draconian sanctions on Russia, cut off its energy shipments, cut off its ability to conduct financial business. Like, Russia was removed from SWIFT. There were hundreds of sanctions placed on imports and exports out of there. They seized their foreign reserves. They tried to get India and China and Africa to pick a side, basically.
Yes, they were removed from SWIFT. I remember that story, but they started up their own, right?
Well, they did, yeah. They were working on it for a while. They have a payment system called Mir, their own credit card, and they have their own payment system. And there's also one they've been working on jointly with China, which I think was part of the reason why they decided to do this too. It wasn't just because of potential electoral troubles and economic troubles in the United States, but also trying to head off the path this Eurasian integration that's been going on for a while now. And so they hit Russia with everything they had all at once. They removed them from the SWIFT banking payment system. They seized their foreign reserves. They they cut off their airspace to Russian aircraft. They seized the assets of Russian billionaires, right? Wealthy people that were living in Europe, and I think, I don't know about the United States, but definitely in Europe, you know, seized their yachts, seized their bank accounts, seized their houses, which it really had nothing to do with anything diplomatic. It was just being mean, just a tantrum, basically. I don't see it as anything more than a tantrum. And I don't think that they really expected that to be a permanent arrangement. I expected that what would happen is the Russian army would grind to a halt fighting the Ukrainians. The Russian economy would swiftly implode. There would be a financial crash, like a biblical proportions, right? And ultimately an uproar, and the hardliners in the Kremlin would remove Putin, and they would get rid of him. And then basically you'd go back to 1991. You would reduce Russia to its collapsed state as it was after the fall of the Soviet Union. And then they would be able to go in once again and, you know, negotiate with somebody that would let Western business move in and start buying up all of their resources and take control of their energy and basically dominate the Eurasian continent. Because the next target after that, obviously, would be China. Then China would be completely surrounded. And then China would absolutely have to march to Washington's drum at that point. Except that it didn't happen. Russia didn't collapse. The ruble went down for a few months, but then it came back up again. And now it's actually too strong. Like they're lowering interest rates to try to keep the ruble from getting too strong. They forced Europe to pay for Russian oil and gas in rubles rather than dollars. They bypassed the dollar system. They've been conducting bilateral trade with China on energy and manufactured goods and raw materials for at least a decade now. And now it appears that they have India on board. You've got a lot of places in the world that, you know, they were forced to pick a side, or America is trying to force them to pick a side. And they're basically saying either we're not taking sides in this, or we're going with Russia. We're going to go with the cheap energy. We're going to go with the cheap food and raw materials because we need them.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of countries that are actually perceiving this as an opportunity to abandon America, not to put too fine a point on it. And this seems to be accelerating. It's something that, you know, was probably going to happen inevitably over decades. But I look at it like, the example that comes to my mind is like a sinking ship or an engineering collapse,
yes.
You know, a structure collapse. You know, it always starts slow. It doesn't happen instantly.
Yes, but then as soon as the dominoes fall, it goes quicker and quicker.
Exactly, yeah. Slowly, 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 then all at once, right? 90% of the action happens in the last 5% of time. Well, I just feel like we're teetering right there.
You know what this reminds me of? This
battleship is underwater.
These war games. How I see it is like a board game. You know, we're moving the pieces around like chess pieces, and then we put a hat on a certain empire. Okay, you're the king now. You're the imperialist for the decade, for the century, and you sort of just move the hat around, and that's the human story.
It is, yeah. Well, hegemony. Right. I mean, you look at, you know, I mean, you could think of Babylon, you could think of Egypt, right? Rome, right? You could look at, you know, the Holy Roman Empire, right? Russia was its own hegemony in that part of the world. I mean, once they fought off the Swedes and the Poles in the 17th and 18th century, then they began to expand eastward. And so they definitely hold a hegemony over most of, you know, the Eurasian continent. It's been theirs for a very long time now. So they're always a big player. The British Empire, of course. But the French, you know, the Spanish, the Portuguese. Ultimately, the Americans got into it. The Germans dipped their toe in it for a while after they became a united empire.
Well, the Red Empire, the Red Dragon is becoming imperialist now, especially with the Great China Sea and all those movements now. So
the thing about China, well, China as it exists right now is an empire. There are about 100 nationalities living in China. So it's in a sense, it's like Russia. Is Russia one country? Yes, but there's about 100 different nationalities there. It is an empire already. You know, and the same as China. I don't think that China is seeking global hegemony. Because I think that China has always considered itself the Middle Kingdom, the center of the world. You know, like kind of like the Ottoman Empire. You know, they controlled the Suez, and they controlled the Bosphorus, right? Like all of that trade from Russia and Central Europe and back and forth. And the Suez Canal, of course, right? So that shortened the route around Africa a great deal. So they controlled that for until the end of World War One, anyway. So, you know, all of these empires that existed, they had decisive advantages that enabled them to maintain their existence for a long time. In the case of the sea powers like America, Britain, Spain, it was because of their ability to project power with their navies. Obviously, the Spanish were the first to be defeated in that regard. But then you have the land powers. You have China, which is one contiguous area. And you have Russia, which is one contiguous area. They have internal lines. You know, you don't need to build ships. All you need to build is a railroad or a pipeline.
That is very true.
And you can move enormous amounts of stuff quickly and continuously. Russia has a lot of advantages, too. I mean, they had a bumper harvest this year when Europe and North America agriculturally didn't do very well at all.
I just had a question come up in my mind, if that's okay. So you were speaking of pipelines earlier, which creates empires. Why did Biden shut down the that pipeline in America?
You know, that's a good question. To me, I mean, from a...
My questions are small, or it's, you know, not many questions, but yeah, they're well thought out.
Yeah. I think that the principal reason is because the people who are transporting oil by rail are going to lose a lot of business. Like Burlington Northern, BNSF, for example, they transport a lot of oil. I think they do about $2 billion a year in revenue, where Warren Buffett is one of the largest owners of BNSF. Mm-hmm. If the pipeline is completed, then the railroad transport of oil becomes redundant. I think it's as simple as that. I think that there are lobby groups in Washington that don't want those pipelines completed. It's not because they don't care about American national interests. It should be obvious they don't care about that. They care about money and not much else. There'd be no reason not to reindustrialize America, because they'd be on the ground floor of investing in all those factories and all of that infrastructure and putting all those people to work. If they were the least bit patriotic, you'd think they'd be proud to do something like that. But they're not. They don't care about that. They care about money. It's not about efficiency. The whole electric vehicle thing, the whole green thing, is a big grift. There's no you can't make a thermodynamic case for it. But they're doing it anyway, and they're doing it with enormous subsidies. I don't think Elon Musk has made a dime on Tesla, but its stock value was the highest Toyota.
I don't care what you think about Musk, good or bad. I think he's just an interesting, entertaining character.
He absolutely is.
I do recall a story, though, of him being upset at Gates because Gates wanted to short Tesla, and Musk was saying, well, how can you be pro-green if you just want to short electric vehicles?
Yeah, there again. Yeah. Well, it's there you go. It's one billionaire firing a shot across the bow of another billionaire.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's like central banks. When your tools aren't working anymore, all you've got is your jawbone. Right. You know, you yell at them in public. What are you doing? What the hell are you doing? You know, to try to get them to change their mind that way.
It's interesting. Yeah, absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And like I said it earlier, it just reminds me of a board game. You know, you're shifting the hat of who's the king now? Who's the imperialist today? Mm-hmm. Who's holding the throne for the day, the century?
Yeah.
Speaking of kings, next song I'm going to play, if that's okay, a bit of a musical break. It's by Megadeth called Kill the King. And then we're going to pick the brains on the final 15-minute segment with the wonderful Supreme Canon, who is a wealth of knowledge. You can hear more from him on the Mike and the Night show, mikeandthenight.com, as well here as here on kiwiradio.nz. KiwiRadio.nz. There is something about rock music and anarchy that comes hand in hand, and that was Megadeth, Kill the King. Welcome back, Supreme, for the final 15-minute segment. I was just saying, man, you are a wealth of knowledge. Thank you for educating me in such wonderful history.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoy the subject a lot. I've always been fascinated by history. I don't know if that makes me an expert, Ralphie.
Well, as they say,
painting the picture as I see it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do appreciate it because, you know, there's that wonderful saying, I guess, that if you know your history, you can predict the future, right?
Well, it certainly rhymes. If it doesn't repeat, it rhymes, as Mark Twain said. And I think that's true. You know, there is nothing new under the sun. That's a very old saying. And, you know, and that was written 3,000 years ago, and it was considered true then, and it's definitely true now. Yeah, you see the rise and fall of empires, and not just nation states, but also personal empires. You know, one day the Musks and the Gates and even the Rothschilds and people like that will be gone.
Yeah, absolutely. We all turn to dust one day.
Yeah, that's right. It's futility. It's chasing after wind. The thing about power is it does corrupt, and that's usually the seeds of the collapse, right? Like, a lot of the empires that have been built in the last 40 or 50 years have been built on nothing.
I've just had an epiphany. I've been watching a lot of documentaries about hoarding, and so if your house is very messy and you start hoarding items, basically the idea about hoarding is what you're trying to get away from, or what you're trying to do is reject your immortality. You're essentially trying to avoid death. And similarly with power, I think it's almost like the more power they consume, they're almost trying to question their own mortality. Like they're trying to, you know what I mean?
There's an obsession with transhumanism now,
yes.
Right? And ultimately, it's the idea of people that want to be immortal. They want to find a way to live. You know, if they can't live forever, well, then they'll live 100
through
years,
the history
200,
books.
through the history books, yeah. Live to be as old as a cedar tree.
I mean,
tree,
we laugh, you know, about it, but there's a certain amount of ego with that kind of level of power.
There definitely is, yeah. It's like, apparently David Rockefeller, who passed away, I think, in 2016, he's said to have had half a dozen heart transplants. You know, this guy would have been, you know, he would have been one of those guys that, you know, young people's blood is an infusion to keep yourself going. He probably, right, no doubt, he experimented with stem cells and stuff. He lived to be 101. I mean, that's as good as you get in this world. But apparently, he was on the operating table in the middle of another heart transplant when they finally lost him. This was a guy who did not want to die.
That's right. And even with all the wealth in the world, you still can't escape that final chapter.
You can't escape it. No, no. And it seems to me that this is the downfall of this particular group. That's been, you know, they've been in the background for quite a long time. Is, I think that they decided that rather than train up the next generation to take the ball over the finish line, that they decided they were going to do it themselves. Because you look at most of these people, their kids are a wreck. You know, in this part of the world, like, the baby boomers get a bad rap, right? For hoovering up all the wealth and keeping all the power to themselves and spending their countries into oblivion, basically putting their unborn great-grandchildren into debt. We've been talking about those things for quite a while. But a lot of it is the same thing. They don't want to give up the wealth and the power. They're not thinking about giving it to the next generation. Because these people, for the most part, are terrified of death. They're terrified of their own mortality.
I mean, the Egyptians were obsessed with death, hence the whole mummification and everything. So why can't the elite be obsessed with death? And they do that through observing more and more power.
It's the thing about the Egyptians is, you know, you lived in a time where diseases would take away, you know, would die in childbirth, right? So they probably hurt rather than helped. You know, mortality was a regular part of life. So, you know, you would turn more to religion, right? Like, most of the major structures that continue to exist from ancient times, the pyramids, the Parthenon, right? Notre Dame, right? The pyramids in Central America and South America, right? These things were built, you know, astronomically perfect, with precise angles and measurements, specific heights. I mean, everything was precise and mathematical. Incredible engineering and capital and labor that went into building these things. And they were all religious buildings. All of them. Everything that left over from the ancient world is pretty much religious buildings. So the idea that religion and technology can't coexist is obviously not true, because the most advanced technology that they had in the ancient world was put into building these enormous temples. Right? So, you know, I mean, they were all aligned with the stars and with the solstice and that kind of thing, right? They're very precise. Stonehenge is another one. Stonehenge looks very crude, but the way it was aligned was, you know, it was astronomically perfect for a particular period of year. They were like calendars made of stone. So I think what you have now is kind of a techno religion being fused with the actual technology, with the belief that we will transcend our mortality. And the idea of hoarding, you build a moat around yourself. We've gone off the subject I was going to finish up on, but I think this is a good one, because I think this ultimately creates their downfall and how we move on to the next thing. You need bottomless energy to be able to run a system like that. You need to sell people on this, right? You need to get people to reject their own mortality, their own biology, their own instincts, their own impulses, things like love, kin, family, nation, tribe, you know, God. You've got to get people to abandon all of these things and take theirs instead. And the problem is that they're so disconnected from the average person now that they're just creepy. There's a large part of the population that just, yeah, okay, whatever, and they'll go with whatever, because they don't have the pattern recognition to see where this goes. They don't have a knowledge of history. You know, they live moment to moment. It is what it is. But there's also a lot of people that see that this isn't going anywhere good. They don't want anything to do with it. They don't want these people having any say in their lives whatsoever. So ironically, even as they build these empires of money and power and even land, the United States and Europe trying to dominate the world as they have for 500 years. Their power is actually slipping away from them. It's falling through their fingers. And I think that's ultimately what's going to happen, is there's going to be a day where Russia, China, India, Iran, half the countries in Africa just announced that they've signed a deal. It's a fait accompli, and from this point on, we've got a different payment system, we've got a different trade arrangement, we've got a different political alignment, and they just default on the U.S. dollar. It absolutely could happen. It could happen at the speed of electrons.
That's the beautiful thing about ideas. It can spread like wildfire overnight.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Babylon was taken by the Medo-Persian army in one night.
That's right. This could all be finished tomorrow.
It could be finished tomorrow. It reminds me of it's actually in the book of Revelation at the back of the New Testament, right? Talking about mystery Babylon, this hidden Babylonian system that collapses in 1 hour. It could happen out of nowhere. It almost did. In 2008, we were less than a day away from the entire global banking system freezing up solid. It's already almost happened once, like within living memory. Like, you know, we were all adults, you know, making a living and doing it when this happened in 2008. And all they've been able to do is just try to paper over these ever widening chasms between true value and perceived value. The problem with 0% money is money was supposed to represent human toil and labor and creativity, and it's supposed to be something that you preserve your value with. But at zero, they're basically saying the machines are worth more than humans. And and you can see that attitude bleeding into people. You get young people, they're not getting married, they're not having kids. Even if they wanted to, they can't afford it. No one in power cares about any of that. They don't care. That's not what they're thinking about. They're sitting behind their moats in their castles, trying to hoard more and more power, more and more money, more and more resources, and basically to be able to buy and sell people as cheaply as possible. And I'm sad to say that it's worked very well. But there are also a lot of people that, you know, they see it for what it is, or at least they can see that they're not going to get a good life out of this. There's nothing being offered to them for this. Look at the nonsense going on in New Zealand right now.
I am in New Zealand, mate.
You are in New Zealand. Yeah, exactly. You see it. You're living in it.
I'm in the Matrix.
You're in the Matrix. Yeah, as am I.
just quickly, speaking of the Matrix, I do want to shout out some of the listeners popping in there. Matthew over in Melbourne, thanks for joining us here at KiwiRadio.nz. And we've got a bit of a crowd in France. And for some reason, we're getting quite the bump in listeners in Chicago. I don't know why.
Interesting. Wow. Well, Chicago, I mean, you know, Chirac, yeah, there'd be a lot of people there wondering what the hell's going on or if it could be fixed too. I think most of our role is going to be hang in, make ourselves as anti-fragile as possible,
yes,
and wait for this thing to implode. Because
absolutely,
it's become so complex and fragile. And now that this master checkmate that they tried to pull on the Russians didn't work, the longer the Russians simply exist and survive is melting their foundations. Like, Europe is in a state of, you know, shaking, of collapse. If Europe collapses, then what's to keep America from collapsing at that point in time? You know, I mean, America isn't just one country anyway. Yeah, it has a federal government, but it's 50 individual states that at least on paper have sovereignty. And there's 5 or 6 different regions in America where the people, you know, they don't really talk to the other regions and they wouldn't get along even if they did. You know, that's the thing about federal states. Same in Canada. We actually have the new premier of Alberta is introducing legislature to basically give the Alberta legislature veto power over anything Ottawa does that they don't like. Because after what happened with the Freedom Convoy this year, earlier this year, and the other things that have been going on, and Ottawa's response to it. Again, people sitting behind a moat, trust fund babies making decisions for regular people.
I've seen those trust fund babies in person. You know my backstory, right? In England,
yes.
I worked for an agency.
Yes.
Yeah, those trust fund babies, you know, 15-year-olds smoking cigars, doing whatever.
Yeah, and they don't live in our world.
Nope.
And there's no sense of noblesse oblige. At least the old aristocracy understood that they owed a duty to the nation.
Yes, there was a sense of not just the entitlement, but the sense of they were custodians. Whereas now it's just party while you're
that's
here
right,
kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And that's the thing. That's what's been going on, especially since the end of World War II. You could kind of understand it. I mean, the Great War carried off a lot of nobility. I mean, a lot of them were like literally killed in the war, right? And then World War II broke out, and of course, a lot of that nobility lost their lands and their titles too, right? So the ones that were left definitely weren't interested in any changes to the status quo. And the thing about democracy is, as long as they could, you know, deficit spend, they could just promise bread and circuses. All right, I mean, bread and circuses sounds like an ominous thing, Ralphie, but bread and circuses bankrupted the Roman Empire.
Yes.
It was a stupid idea. But the reason that they did it was because they couldn't be bothered as elites to try to inspire their people to a national identity anymore. They just wanted to get drunk and get off.
Yes. As many
you know what? I'm just going to say it that way. Yeah, they want more orgies and more bacchanalia and more travel and more sunshine and, you know, more slaves and more money and more power. And you get to the point where, you have this disconnect between the leaders and the people. And that's very dangerous because now they don't know what's happening down below. They expect the surveillance state to keep them on top. And it has worked. It's like the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had an enormous surveillance state, huge resources dedicated just to keeping the people in their place so that the leaders could stay where they were. But it was pretty obvious by the mid-60s that it wasn't going to work. you know, and then the 70s and into the 80s, it was just basically the last of the old guard waiting for their turn to sit in the big chair before they died. This is how small-minded they were by then. Oh, well, I don't have any more ideas, but I'm just going to get mine. And that's where we are. You know, our nations are falling apart, and these people are just concentrating on, okay, well, we'll bring out a digital currency, and we'll do this and we'll do that, and people will just accept it. But I don't think they will, because they're not offering anything with it. At least bread and circuits, you were getting something. Now they're offering you nothing.
You got to be careful with the breads and circuses, because the news cycle is very fast, but the more important stories are buried very quickly, you know, in between two fluffy stories, you know?
They are, but most of the big stories that you and I know of now, we weren't supposed to know at all.
No.
You know, they weren't paying attention. They thought the internet was going to be their big, you know, global control grid, but they didn't bother to see what else was going on there. And it wasn't until Brexit, and it wasn't until, Trump, you know, it wasn't until counter narratives really suddenly, they didn't just emerge, but they emerged into the public consciousness. It's like, holy cow, you know, this is what's really going on. And you could see the contrast. So a counter narrative has emerged very quickly, and it grows in strength by the day. And even if it doesn't have direct governmental control, if people refuse to be governed, there's not much the state can do. You know, they can try to whack the tall poppies, but,
well,
you know, it doesn't change anybody else's mind.
The truth is on our side. And
the truth is on our side.
Have you ever tried to lie upon a lie upon a lie? You know, it's really hard, but when you tell the truth, it's quite easy.
And on that note,
I do thank you again, Supreme, for this wonderful 1 hour podcast, which you can download as a replay if you like on KiwiRadio.nz. I learn something every time I have a wonderful chat with you. And this next song is going to outro our podcast today. It's by Prophets of Rage, which is a super band of members from Rage Against the Machine, Public Enemy, and Cypress Hill. Again, thank you very much, Supreme, for being on the show and just being a wonderful mind, a wonderful human being.
It's always a pleasure, Ralphie. It's great to chat again. Let's do it again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. What a jam-packed full show today. Lots of information, and again, it can all change tomorrow if we just push on. The point of this podcast is basically the theme of this song. What we're trying to do is to reverse the world. They say a more colorful word here, but you know me, I'm clean as a bean. Again, Supreme, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for everyone tuning in today. Here's some rock and roll for you. You're listening to KiwiRadio.nz. Take care of yourselves. Let's take care of each other. Yeah.
they looking strange here. Engineers got millennials living in fear. Give a damn, evil can't stand. Yeah, when the people take a stand. Come on, no hatred. Fuck racist, black faces. Time changing, one nation. Unification, the vibration. I fuck the world, no hatred. Fuck racist, black faces. Time changing, one nation. Unification, the vibration. I fuck the world.
We're trying to do, boys and girls. Ah, yes. We got to smile while in trenches too, right? Keep each other company.
The straw that broke the camel's back, the gun in the car jack, the nightstick that keeps cracking down, the resistance never backing down.
And that's the show. Back to our regular programming now, streaming on kiwiradio.nz. I've been your host, Ralphie, special guest supreme there in Canada. Thank you for joining us today. Have a wonderful day.
Enjoying the sounds at kiwiradio.nz? We are a listener-supported radio station, so head over to the music page. There's a paywall, $2 a month, New Zealand. We'll keep our servers alive. Also, if you've got original music, submit them to kiwiradio.nz/contact. We'd love to air it.
See you later. Thanks for keeping us company.